18. Exit music for the Anthropocene. April 21, 1951, Isle of Brooklyn proper. A light wind is blowing from the northeast, and the morning smells like oil. The sky is filled with hungry, noisy gulls. From her perch on the roof, Inamorata is using old Duarte's spyglass, trying to spot the slick she's been told rose up in the night, a great black bubble freed by a breach in one of the ancient concrete storage tanks. It only takes her a moment to pin it down, a muddy, iridescent smudge marring the blue-green shimmer of Queen's Bar, less than half a mile out from Prospect Beach. A slick that long, that wide, it could easily yield 15, maybe 20,000 gallons. She's seen bigger, but not for several years now, and not since the HUD extended its reach to the barrier islands. It's surprising there's not already a company team on the scene, siphoning it off. There will be soon enough, surely by noon. Noon at the latest. One of the big sweeper skiffs docked at Carnegie Island and a host of support vessels will slip smooth and silent through the heat haze, set up shop and get to it. And any jackals caught trying to nip a tub or three will be sunk on sight, with the governor's blessing. But for now, the slick is a pristine blemish on the sea. In this light and at this hour, it's almost beautiful, the way that so many poisonous things are beautiful. Inamorata puts down the spyglass just as Heli comes up from below. She's a Sanderling girl, is Heli Nunez, stalking the drift lines for whatever refuse the tides fetch up. She's 19, and most of her life she spent on the row, with the other beachcombers and the crabbers and the bums. Before she met Inamorata, before they became lovers and Heli came to live with her in old Duarte's house on Cemetery Hill, she worked for one of the black market agents. Now Inamorata has her registered with a legal picker syndicate, and Heli gets top dollar and doesn't have to worry quite so much about the law.
"You've seen it, then?" she asks Inamorata.
"I've seen it," Inamorata replies.
"It's a gopher," says Heli,
and she sits down near Inamorata's perch and begins emptying her morning's haul of plastic out onto the roof to dry and be sorted. In the sunlight, Heli's auburn hair shines like a new copper pot.
"It's big," Inamorata tells her,
"but it's not as big as all that." Heli shrugs and pulls a fat wad of green nylon fishing line from her gunny sack, all tangled with wire weed and kelp.
"Well, Joe Sugar, he says it's a gopher."
Joe Sugar lets on, and you know he hasn't seen it for himself. "Good take?"
"Oh, just you see this," Heli grins,
and she looks up, squinting at the bright morning sky, cloudless and a shade of blue so pale it might as well be alabaster.
"Down at the pilings, right in close with Fincher's docks, there was a stranding. All of its starfish and urchins, hundreds upon hundreds of them, thousands even maybe. Starfish and urchins big about as my hand. I think they might have washed up current from Park's sloop or the slaughter."
Inamorata looks back to the sea again, staring out across the water towards the oil.
"Could have been poisoned by the slick," she says half to herself. "Maybe. There was some sheen on the sand, so might have been the slick got them. But anyway, that ain't the point of it."
And then Heli reaches deep into her sack and pulls something out from the very bottom.
"This," she says, and holds it up for Inamorata to see. "Found it at the stranding, mixed in with the dead stuff. It's jade, I think. Real jade, not poly or resin. Gaspar already offered me an even 20 for it before I could get back here, which means it's worth 80, easy and sure."
Inamorata is island-born and island-raised, not so much more than a Sanderling herself, and in her 27 years she's seen her share of ugliness and misbegotten dragged in by the tides. There's a whole drowned world out there, always puking up its secrets and mistakes, the shameful ghosts of a wasted, shiny petrol city that went under before her grandmother's mother was born. But this
is something rare indeed.
The milky green lump in Heli's hand, and it catches her off guard.
"Looks Japanese," says Heli. "Doesn't it look Japanese? I think maybe it's an oni or a dragon."
To Inamorata, it doesn't look much like either. Heli holds it out to her,
and Inamorata leans forward and takes the thing from her hand. It's about as big around as her balled-up fist and heavy. Definitely stone, though she's hardly qualified to say whether the thing is actually jade or not. She holds it up to the sun and finds that it's translucent. Whoever carved it, whenever and why ever it was carved, however many decades or centuries ago, they'd clearly meant to convey something terrible, and Inamorata would have to admit that they succeeded in spades. The word that comes first to her mind is troll, because when she was little, her mother told her a fairy story about three nanny goats trying to cross the ruins of the Williamsburg Bridge. But there was an enormous sea troll nesting below the span, a monstrous, malformed creature of slime and muck and rusted steel, and whenever the goats tried to cross, the troll would rise up and threaten to eat them. This thing that Helly's found on the beach, it could be the graven likeness of her mother's bridge troll, a refugee from Inamorata's childhood nightmares. Except she always imagined the troll to be male, though she can't recall whether her mother ever explicitly stated that it was. The maybe jade thing, it's unmistakably female, an obscene caricature of the feminine form, from the exaggerated fullness of its breasts, hips, and buttocks to the gape of its vulva. But its bulging eyes, those make her think of the fishmonger's stalls down on the row, and the mass of finger-like tendrils sprouting from its belly remind her of a sea anemone. "It's not the bridge troll," Helly says, and Inamorata frowns and looks at her, then looks back at the ugly lump of green stone she's holding. Emile Duarte, who's 73 and went to school in some faraway dry place, has referred to Helly as an innate 12th hierarchy intuitive, and he has explained to Inamorata how people like Helly are used by the military and the multi-corps. Down on the row, there were folks who called her a witch, who thought she was possessed by demons because of the way she often knows things that she shouldn't know, that she has no way of knowing, and that she can never explain how she knows. Inamorata hasn't ever told Helly Nunes about her mother's bridge troll story. "And Gaspar offered you 20, she asks, passing the thing back to Helly. The stone feels slippery, oily, and when she looks at her fingers and palms, they glisten like she's been handling slugs. She wipes her hands on her skirt. "I can do better," Helly replies. "Probably," Inamorata agrees. "Have Sully post it for you full span. I'll cover the tab. You want more than 20, then the buyer's gonna have to come from somewhere besides the island." "Will do," says Helly, turning the thing over and over, examining the object from every angle. Admiring it, Inamorata thinks, and the thought gives her an unpleasant little shiver. To her, it isn't horrible at all. "I wish you could have seen all those starfish and urchins," Helly says, and she returns the green thing to her gunny. "Heaps of them, thousands and thousands. Like maybe the sea's gotten bored with starfish and urchins and sent them all packing." And just then, far out across the water, a siren starts to wail. A few seconds later, another pipes up, and shortly after that, a third joins the chorus, the shrill cry of the Hudson Authority's hurricane warning towers. Inamorata picks up the spyglass again and scans the low waves, but there's still no sign of a company crew. Only a few ragged fishing boats bobbing and rolling and going about their day-to-day business. The waves, the boats, and the slick. Nothing she can see to warrant an alarm. "What's happening?" asks Helly, sounding more curious than concerned. "Why would they wind up the screamers on a day like today? There's not a cloud in the sky." "I don't know," Inamorata tells her, and then she focuses on the slick, which seems bigger than it did only 5 or 10 minutes before. An enormous flock of gulls has gathered above it, and she watches as the birds dive one by one from the sky and plummet head first into the oil. There's no splash when they hit, not even a sludgy ripple. They're just gone. But odder still, the slick seems to be drifting nearer Prospect Beach, moving south and east, even though the current from the sound should be pushing it west off towards Liberty Bay. "You go find Emile," she says, and the way she says it, Helly doesn't hesitate, and she doesn't ask why. She just gets up and heads quickly back downstairs, shouting for the old man. Inamorata doesn't take her eye from the spyglass, not looking away from the falling birds or the shimmering oily patch hardly half a mile from shore now and creeping slowly closer. But she's thinking of that ugly chunk of stone from Helly's sack, and she's thinking of dead starfish and sea urchins, and she's remembering the way her mother did the voice of the bridge troll. And the sirens scream. This concludes The Tyndalos Asset by Caitlin R. Kiernan, narrated by Chelsea Stevens. Copyright 2020 by Caitlin R. Kiernan. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Caitlin R. Kiernan, care of Writers House, LLC, and was produced in the year 2020 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.